The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays, everyone. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 23, The Adventure of the Reigate Squire. And joining me in just a moment is Mary Alcaro. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Ed. How are you?
I am good, Mary. You know, including tonight, there are just 8 shows left. So
I can't believe it. I feel like we just started this.
We did, several months ago.
Feels probably longer for you since you come up with every week.
Well, we have 8 more shows of Sherlock Mondays to deduce, decipher, dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in a kind of conversational annotation. As you're watching right now, I ask you to please like these videos, to subscribe to this channel. If you're watching live, have fun in the live chat. Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast, so hello to all of our podcast listeners. Thanks for tuning in. And I ask everyone if you would please consider making a donation to the Rosenbeck. If you've already donated or joined as a member, thank you so much. That's really how we get to do this show for free, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. So if you have not already donated or become a member, I invite you to do so. Or if you can make a further donation, I invite you to do so as well. It really does make a big difference. Any amount helps. But Mary, before we start talking tonight, I can ask you, what are we drinking?
We are drinking a rest cure, because I love a pun.
I love it. Rest. I see what you did there. Well done.
I'm terrible. I'm going to be a great dad someday. So this is not hard to make. And I think it's got a nice balance to it. This is about 2 ounces of sherry, about a half an ounce of the orange liqueur of your choice. You could also use triple sec. Half an ounce of dry vermouth. Shake it up in a shaker, strain into a coupe glass, and don't forget your orange wheel for garnish.
That's what I did, because Sherlock knocks over the oranges. So
I played up the orange wheel. It dwarfs my
orangier than mine.
So. Yeah, because I cheated a little bit with I'm away from my bar cart, so.
Okay. I told you I had trouble getting good sherry at the local PA fine wines and spirits store. They only had junk. And but I use dry sack is what I use. A sack is a combination of sherries. And yes, it's a little bit it's good. So
absolutely balance out in here with the triple sack. See, it's not fine wines. It's fine wines.
And I could be a little Falstaff like with my sack. So well, every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by our good friend and co-host, Mary Alcaro. You can find the recipes in the YouTube description for each episode. And I also send out the recipe via email every week for those of you who are registered for the show. You can register at the Sherlock Mondays homepage on rosenbeck.org. Well, Mary, it has been too long because you missed an episode. So we're bringing you back. So we're very happy to come for you, have you back. And I think when you were gone, what happened was we now have a poet laureate. I don't think you were on a show where we had this, did you?
I was not.
One of our viewers, Claire Danes, who watches from Canterbury, New Zealand, has been posting poems for the stories in the YouTube comments. So it's after every episode runs, then we get the... And then she went back and started putting poems in for the earlier episodes.
Gosh, what a talent.
So, and they're all fun. They're all, some of them are parodies, like some of them were limericks. Last week's was a total tongue twister that I managed to deliver. I was shocked. But the Musgrave Ritual from the new one from Claire goes, "Twinkle, twinkle, royal hat, how I wonder where you're at, down below in cellar room, leading butler to his doom."
Fantastic. I'll drink to that.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Cheers, Claire. And Claire has a book also featuring her verse. It's available from MX Publishing. MX creates a lot of great Sherlockian books. This one is called The Hunting of the Narc, Sherlock Holmes Through the Looking Glass. And the copy on it says, imagine a world where the logic of Sherlock Holmes meets the nonsense of Wonderland. The Hunting of the Narc combines the best of Lewis Carroll and Arthur Conan Doyle's adventures into a madcap collection of verse, including the novella-length case, The Adventure of the Twinkling Hat. That sounds like a lot of fun. And also, and especially with the Rosenbach, we have this massive, great Lewis Carroll collection too. So maybe, you know, as if that happens someday in the future for a show like this, maybe we get to bring in some more of Claire Danes's poems. But that book, The Hunting of the Narc, is also illustrated by another of our viewers, Madeline Quinones, who you know well, I think, as a wonderful Sherlockian. So even more reason to get that. And we've put the link for that book in our chat. And somebody's already asking, what's the Reigate Squire poem? Well, that'll be in the comments when the show is over. So, or Claire, you could share it in the live chat, but I'd make them wait until the end.
So, for dramatic effect.
There you go. Well, on with our story, shall we? I actually have a lot of notes for this story.
I love this story. I really do.
Good. Well, then we've shared a PDF of a facsimile of The Adventure of Reigate Squire as it was originally published in the June 1893 issue of The Strand Magazine. You can download that on the Rosenbach's Sherlock Mondays page. And just even before we started, the title of this adventure in The Strand, as it was originally published, and in the American Strand, was The Adventure of the Reigate Squire. And then, but it was also published in Harper's Weekly in America, and that title was The Reigate Puzzle.
Yeah.
And then when the book edition came out, the memoirs, Conan, it was called The Adventure of the Reigate Squires, plural. So
just like, to make it totally confusing for all parties.
What it was, here's a picture of the Harper's page with the puzzle on it. It's a whole magazine. It was a magazine, and you can see the full page here.
Yeah.
And like up top, it is, you know, it's The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. And then just the title is here, just beginning over the story. This is the Reigate. And I'm pretty sure this is how they did, you know, their titles. We'll see this a couple times because the way they share the clue is slightly altered as well. Not in text, but we'll share a little bit more of this to start. But the Reigate Puzzle, which, I mean, I think they made the choice. I mean, they made the choice of what they wanted to change it to.
I assume.
But it is. Somebody asked, is this the story on one page? No, it's over three different pages that the story runs. So, and the last page, even it didn't fill it. So there's a poem. So, not one by, you know, Claire, but just another.
Unless
poem.
Claire is a time traveler.
There you go. Well, she could be. So
we don't through the looking glass.
Yeah, Reigate Puzzle or Reigate Squire. I mean, it's.
I don't.
It kind of works. This is the well. There might be an answer to that a little later.
An answer to the puzzle, as it were.
Yeah, well, an answer to why they took Squire out.
Okay.
I have a note on that.
Nice. Love that. I'm here for the notes.
All righty. Well, this has one of the great beginnings here. Read the opening two sentences there.
I love this opening. It was some time before the health of my friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, recovered from the strain caused by his immense exertions in the spring of 87. The whole question of the Netherland Sumatra Company and of the colossal schemes of Baron Maupertuis are too recent in the minds of the public and are too intimately concerned with politics and finance to be fitting subjects for this series of sketches.
Mic drop. Great. I love, you know, another unpublished case. We love those when we see them. And the name, the Netherlands Sumatra Company and the colossal schemes of Baron Maupertuis, or whatever, however you say that. I want that story. I'm sure it's been written. So I'm sure there's, you know, I'm sure
that is the great fun of Sherlockiana, is for every name dropped case, there are like two or three pastiches that are just bananas.
You can find, you can definitely find somebody's done this as a pastiche. But then the other, you know, it was too intimately concerned with politics and finance to be a fitting subject for this series of sketches. No.
That'd be great. We talk about this shit all the time.
I love that. Please give me politics and finance, and you know, that would be fun. I mean, technically, that was, or at least the finance part was the stockbroker's clerk. So.
Yeah. Watson signed an NDA, it sounds like, with the Netherlands Sumatra Company.
And then he says that, but Watson says, this case gave my friend an opportunity of demonstrating the value of a fresh weapon among the many with which he waged his lifelong battle against crime. I'm sorry, I should read the whole sentence, because it led, however, in an indirect fashion to a singular and complex problem, which gave my friend an opportunity of demonstrating. Mm-hmm. So him solving that leads him to then do this Reigate case. I'm reading that correctly there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So able to bring, you know, a fresh kind of, you know, weapon to it, which is, you know, had he not shown up at this place, it never would have gotten solved, right? It would just been the country squires would have just chalked it up to another robbery gone wrong, and it never would have happened. So
exactly. Holmes, it's so funny, because I read that sentence and I'm like, oh, the fresh weapon is malingering. That is the fresh weapon that he
is the what?
Malingering.
Yeah. He decides
that
he's gonna
that is the weapon Holmes brings in this story, in addition to his powers of deduction.
Well, Watson gives us a date, the 14th of April. He gets a telegram from Lyon in which he finds out that Holmes is ill at the Hotel Dulong. His iron constitution had broken down under the strain of an investigation which had extended over 2 months. He never worked less than 15 hours a day and had more than once, as he assured me, kept to his task for 5 days at a stretch. So Sherlock being Sherlock, this is what he does. If he's hot on a case, he's not stopping.
No, he has no Watson to tell him, but Holmes, your health.
But, and then he says he's gotten all these telegrams, you know, of congratulations. Then when Europe was ringing with his name.
Oh, I love that. And when his room was literally ankle deep with congratulatory telegrams. It's such a great image of just like Watson wading through the hotel room telegrams and Holmes just like laid out.
I think it's the first time that he's mentioned his fame abroad. Stories we've done so far. He's of course mentioned that he's been involved in other cases, and of course Scandal in Bohemia starts with you know, one that involved, you know, the continent, but I think this might be the first case where he talks about how, you know, he is famous outside of England as well. And then which just kind of adds to that. It winds up adding to that mystique that Doyle is creating about the detective, both in the stories, but also in reality. As readers are, you know, encountering this, it's like, oh, yes, this is the most famous detective I've ever read. And they're talking about it each other. In real life, he's becoming that famous. But
it's true.
But he's not yet that famous in the publishing world. He's not been translated yet in Europe, right. I don't think. Right. None of that. It doesn't really happen until the 20th century when, you know, Sherlock leaves for a while and then comes back, that suddenly, you know, there's, you know, Russian and French translations running, you know, constantly as the stories are coming out.
One of the very cool things about the home stories and how long they run for and how long Conan Doyle is writing them, is you do go from that conceit in the stories where Holmes is this like bright young amateur who's doing all the actual detective work but gets no credit in the official press, and is sort of out there hustling. And then that illusion just can't be sustained within the world of the stories because his fame as a character bleeds through into the real world. Yeah. And it's funny to watch Conan Doyle have to pivot with that, that Holmes has to become a famous figure in the text because he is such a well-known figure outside of it. And it's just amazing to watch and to wonder, you know, if Conan Doyle had had his way, and had been able to do the two sets of stories and that's it.
Yeah.
If we would have seen, Holmes, the sort of master sage detective, evolve.
Yeah. And we would have only had one set of stories, and then
we would have had one. He already had his arm twisted during the second set. So,
and they were so popular, and they were meeting how much money he was going to get for them. So, you know, it's
grumble, grumble, grumble.
He didn't want to, but did. Oh, sure, you know. And then we still get great stories even towards the very end.
We do. And I'm a very much a casebook apologist. There's a lot of gold in the casebook.
Yeah.
That people have tended to kind of dismiss, because it has some of the less popular stories in it. But now that everything's out of copyright, I think we're really going to see more circulation. We're going to see those stories showing up more and more, and cases that really deserve the love, Blanche Soldier, I think people will become more familiar with.
Good. Well, in this story, first Watson brings him back to Baker Street, but then he promises, Holmes needs a rest. Does he, why is he collapsed? Is it really because of the exhaustion, or is it because the case is over? Well, I think we'll see what happens once they get on another case. But Watson recommends a week of springtime in the country. My old friend Colonel Hayter, who had come under my professional care in Afghanistan. By the way, did you know I was once in the military in Afghanistan? So he can't help talking about his less than 1 year service.
Poor Watson. He's double wounding.
He has a house near Reigate.
Yes.
In Surrey, and wants Holmes to come down. And Holmes, though, once he understood, go ahead, read that.
No girls. A little diplomacy was needed. But when Holmes understood that the establishment was a bachelor one and that he would be allowed the fullest freedom, he fell in with my plans. And a week after our return from Lyon, we were under the colonel's roof.
Bachelor week, baby.
Bachelor week, no chicks.
Keggers, tattoos.
Absolutely. You know. Like The Hangover, the movie, like they did it first.
With Sherlock.
Speaking of no boys, give me just 1 second. I'll be right.
All righty.
Gotta go resolve an issue.
Mary has to go let someone into her place here. She's the only one with the key. And then as soon as they're there, you know, resting, Holmes is, they're sitting in the colonel's gun room after dinner with Holmes stretched upon the sofa. And this is where I want to share an image, a Sidney Paget image here from the story. And here it is with Holmes lounging on the sofa at a friend's house. I've mentioned this before, how, you know, we've had a few pictures. This is actually the fourth. Gloria Scott, cardboard box, blue carbuncle, and now this one where we get a illustration of Holmes lounging upon a sofa.
Love it.
And for me, it's just a little, I think it just kind of makes him not quite the respectable hero that Victorian men are supposed to be in doing
that. I love Watson's wagging finger.
Yeah.
In the illustration.
But Holmes is just going to chill out and relax. It's bachelor week. He can do what he wants. It's the gun room. So Paget's given us some rifles in the wall here, a couple guns just stuck on the wall. Fantastic. And, but hanging out in the gun room after dinner, as one does.
As one does on Bachelor Weekend.
Yes. Hang out in the gun room. I keep the pistols away from Sherlock, though. So, or you.
If you respect your walls. Yeah, absolutely.
Find your walls, you know, bullet pocked with initials.
Maybe that is the activity this weekend at a country.
Then it would become a hangover movie, right? This is
absolutely,
you know, yeah, shooting the walls and doing.
You just need a tiger. It's good. We'll go back to Grimsley Roylott's place and scoop up the moon and some other exotic critters.
Someone did ask a question: why are they wearing tails at boys' night out? You still wear your evening wear for dinner. There's no, you know, there's no changing that.
I feel like that's more about class than it is about occasion.
Yeah. Well, they find out from the colonel as they're sitting there that the colonel mentions, I'll take one of these pistols upstairs in case we have an alarm.
Just drops that in.
Yeah. I'm just going to take a pistol to bed with me. And apparently, old Acton, who was one of our county magnates, had his house broken into last Monday. The fellows are still at large, and Holmes right away. No clue.
You can see him kind of like pulling up from the sofa, like.
And the colonel's like, it's nothing. It's too small for you. And
yeah.
I like that Holmes waved away the compliment. His smile showed that it had pleased him. Right. That Holmes' ego is there from the beginning.
Absolutely. It's there. No, I don't need the praise. Tell me more.
But of course, he asks about this, any feature of interest. And he says they ransacked the library, but took like a bunch of odd things, an odd volume of Pope's Homer, two pleated plated candlesticks, an ivory letter weight, a small oak barometer, and a ball of twine. Somebody even noticed the ball of twine was gone. Hey, wait, where's my ball of twine?
Right, like, how do you? It's got the makings of, gosh, I'm losing the titles of my cases. This drink may be better than I originally thought it was.
Well, this is, you know, and Holmes is immediately intrigued by hearing this because it's an odd assortment of things.
Right.
And that's the exact same thing that happened in Musgrave Ritual.
Yes.
That, I mean, well, he heard that there was a ritual, and so he had to hear about that. But the last case made it start with we pulled up the linen bag, and it's got some pieces of metal and pebbles in it. And
Twine Week. I don't know.
And what does that mean? And then we get, it's a great setup for a story, too. It's like, this is the strange clue here. Now find out at the end what it means. So in this case, it winds up, it's, you know, it's a red herring, but Holmes even knows that right off the bat. It's not a red herring from him. He knows he doesn't have to solve why somebody took a ball of twine.
Right. The barometer on the piano is, in fact, just there for realism. It is just there to remind us that sometimes you just have random objects in your library that just get burgled.
Yeah.
But it is amazing that he dismisses the twine here. That does almost feel like a deliberate misdirection after that was so important in the last
one. Yeah, because you know, you had to measure, you know, the distance last time. But
I wonder if Strand readers are like, oh, maybe it's a thing with the twine again.
Right. But Holmes, he says when the colonel's like, oh, they just grabbed it and they could get a hold of, Holmes grunted from the
sofa.
He realizes, no, that's actually, and he knows right off the bat, he'll confirm this later. He knows right off the bat that this was a ruse on purpose. Of course, Watson interrupts right away. I held up a warning finger.
So good.
From that illustration. You are here for a rest, my dear fellow. For heaven's sake, don't get started on a new problem when your nerves are all in shreds.
Geez, good thing there are no women here to henpeck us. Tell us to be careful.
You know, if you smile, Sherlock, you'll feel a little better.
It's just that time of the month, Sherlock. You're fine. Walk it off. I love Holmes's response to this wagging finger as the complete overly dramatic shrugging of shoulders and glance of comic resignation towards the colonel, and then they change the subject, but we know that he's a dog with a bone, and he can't really move on from this.
And he's like, see what I have to put up with in Baker Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, all of Watson's professional caution is wasted, he says. For the next morning, the problem obtruded itself upon us in such a way that it was impossible to ignore it. The colonel's butler rushes in. Have you heard the news, sir? Burglary, cried the colonel, with his coffee cup in midair. Murder.
So good.
These are the kind of things that have become, you know, cliche now. Even in the image of it happening, someone rushing in. Yeah. Have you heard? Murder. But Doyle, for a modern reader, overdoes it with the whole, like, I pose with the coffee cup in midair. Right. But we didn't have these cliches yet. Well, or we did, and we just don't know it. But
this is the time that we were like, oh, don't do that again. That's just a little overcommitment to the bit. You can sort of feel like this is the cold open before the title sequence, right? Murder. And then we get Sherlock Holmes in the case of the Reigate puzzle /squires.
Well, even the whole, you know, the whole scheme here, that's, you know, the detective goes off somewhere and sure enough, I'm on vacation and a murder happens. Yeah. You know, this happens to Jessica Fletcher.
This is what you said when you emailed me. You're like, it's murder she wrote. And it kind of is.
There's an episode of Columbus where he goes on a cruise and Columbo, where he goes on a cruise and a murder happens. I think we're in Mexico and port and a murder happens and he has to solve it because, oh, Columbo's here. Well, he can solve it. Or Jessica's here. She'll solve the case for us.
Exactly. These people never get a break.
So the, you know, perhaps the beginning of that kind of cliche getting started in mystery stories.
Well, I do love this description of the colonel's butler, though, rushing in with all of his propriety shaken out of him. Like, that is such a great line.
This is such a serious thing that even the butler has his propriety shaken out of him.
Not the butler.
What does that look like?
I know. And then the whistle. The colonel takes this all, like, pretty much in stride. The butler's really upset, but the colonel's like, whoop! Well, which one was it? Was it the kid or was it the colonel? And it's neither.
No, it's another servant. It's William the coachman. Shot.
No wonder the butler's so upset.
Shot through the heart. I won't Bon Jovi lyric it.
I was a little concerned that that's where we were headed.
I'm not.
We can only infringe on so many copyrights.
I'm not going to do it. So. So
yeah, it makes sense that the butler's upset. They shot another servant. He could be
and next. then he says he's describing to Holmes who it is, and he says where it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the house that it happened.
Pantry window.
He's our leading squire about here is old Cunningham and a very decent fellow too. Ha ha. Here's where I'm going to mention the squire thing.
Mm.
In the Harper's text, it says man instead of squire.
Interesting.
Now, it makes me wonder, I don't think that they thought American readers didn't know what a squire
was. Squire.
But did they, it leads me to think, did they think that that's a kind of, I don't know, was it a class thing for Harper's Magazine? And that kind of, you know, snooty title for someone as a squire. But now that they've taken it out of the title, and now they've changed the only time it appears? Let me do a quick search on that.
That's a really interesting point, Ed.
It is the only time it appears in the story, and they changed it to man. So... it's odd, you know, that both times the squire appears, they've taken it out. They changed the title and they've changed it to man here. Maybe the one led to the other because they changed the title. They wanted to take it out there. I don't know. So, there's the question too that they thought it might give it away.
Oh.
That it winds up, you know, because we've all read this. It's not a spoiler for us now, but that that it's the squire. Is the one, but it happened at his house, so I don't think that really gives it away. it's curious that they've changed it.
Yeah. I think the Strand has, yeah, Raggate Squire, but it's got his man, which is interesting. Let me cut up over this for the, oh, it's servant. Nope, nope, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's curious. I wonder why.
Well, it is, he will evidently be cut up because he was a good service and been with him for many years. Well, I hope he said that his servant was murdered
on his
doorstep.
Yeah. Kind of upsetting.
And Hayter right away thinks that, oh, it must have been the same guys that broke into Acton's. And Holmes is like, and stole that very singular collection.
Holmes piping up from the sofa, you can imagine.
Yeah. And then he thinks it's just a little curious. He says, and here's where he confirms it. He says, I remember that it passed through my mind that this was probably the last parish in England to which thieves will be likely to turn their attention, which shows that I have still much to learn. Oh, okay, not yet. But Holmes is even like, wow, I didn't think I'd have to solve a crime. I just thought something, you know.
Which is interesting, right? After we've heard that how suspicious Holmes is about, in the Copper Beaches, about how suspicious he is of the sort of wide open country estates that don't have the
right
social regulation.
Yeah, this is where the murders can happen and people can get away with it.
So is he surprised or is he leaning into this?
Not if Sherlock is vacationing there, though.
Nope. Crime rate just skyrockets anytime he...
But they all get caught.
It's true. Incarceration rate is like 100% to the... So Holmes saying, oh, I still have much to learn is interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then we find out now's when we start to get in some information. Now's when we, as the readers and Sherlock himself, are getting clues.
Yeah. We find out about the lawsuit that's going on.
Which has sucked the blood out of both of them.
Right. Biggest estates, but not necessarily the richest estates because of this ongoing, legal battle.
And Acton has a claim on half of Cunningham's estate. And then Holmes yawns. All right, Watson, I'm not going to meddle. And then the inspector shows up.
Good morning. Now he has to meddle.
I hope I don't intrude, but we hear that Mr. Holmes of Baker Street is here.
It literally invites him. We thought you might like to step across, Mr. Holmes. And
I hear the renowned mystery author Jessica Fletcher staying here. She might would like to know about this murder.
The fates are against you, Watson. And even Holmes can't help but laugh at poor Watson, who's just foiled at every turn to be like, but you're on holiday. And he's like, nah.
Of course, as soon as this all happens, though, now he leans back in his chair in a familiar attitude. I knew that the case was hopeless. He's doing his listening pose in the chair to hear everything. And he's fine. And so this is what makes me wonder. Was the end of this case in Europe because he had worked himself to death or just because it was over?
Right.
Now, this, because we've heard this so many times. As soon as the case ends, he's... You know, he can't do anything. He's indolent. Mm-hmm. He lies around. He does cocaine because, you know, he's bereft of, you know, solving a problem.
It's so interesting the way his illness is described throughout this. And I'm sure we'll get more into it as he suffers from his attacks going through here. But the ambiguity with which the Victorians treat what we would call mental illness or mental health in general, and how delicate they are surrounding that mind-body connection. And we talked about it with brain fever several times on the show and among guests. But what is Holmes's issue when he gets here? We know that he is in a deep depression. His nerves have broken down. He's lying in his sick room. Is it exhaustion? Is it depression? Like, we don't quite get the language of either a full commitment to physical malady. But we also, it's also treated, of course, with some degree of physicality, because I think still it would be unmanly to need a proper rest cure the way that a woman might. I'm thinking of the yellow wallpaper right now.
Yeah.
Actually. And I was thinking of it when at the Charlotte Perkins Gilman Perkins, who writes, of course, about a woman who has been told by her husband that she's doing too much and that she needs to rest herself, right? She needs to not trouble her pretty little head about too much thinking. And that is, in fact, the thing that ends up driving her insane.
Yeah. She gets gaslit and then goes insane from the gaslighting. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'll try to think of one in particular. As far as I can recall, this does happen to men in Victorian novels as well. That this is, I mean, clearly it's more likely for the woman to, like, you know, be, you know, upset or you know, suffering from stress. But it's not unusual for it to happen to men in these stories.
Oh. It does seem to be the same cluster of what we would understand as the same cluster of symptoms, but it's labeled very differently.
Yes.
Like, it's never hysteria when it's a man. Hysteria, I mean, obviously the word comes from the word for womb, but it's hysteria when it's a woman. It's nervous exhaustion.
When
it's a man. Yeah. Brain fever seems to be both in this period. But it's just, it's curious the way that this is comes up in a lot of my research, professionally, about what are the words that we use to describe, words associated with mental health and where they overlap with physical health and how does this change and who gets diagnosed with what, you know, poor people go insane. But rich people, suffer from nervous disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always just curious. And we get more physical symptoms from Holmes later in the story, which I don't want to hold this up too long.
Well, when he pretends.
It's interesting about how those are plotted.
But he knows that he can use those things to pretend.
Yeah. And Watson is, and I'm sure we'll come back to this, but Watson's convinced. It's in keeping for Watson with what he is sort of preemptively diagnosed.
Mm-hmm. Another thing about this story that I like to mention is that it's a country house murder mystery. You know, the kind of murder mystery that was popularized in the 20th century, Agatha Christie, Niall Marsh, Dorothy Sayers, that kind of closed circle at a country estate, you know, where you get the kind of relations between the upper class and the staff and something has gone wrong. That's what's going on in this story, but it's not, I just think it's more of a case that this is a precursor to what later writers create, the country house murder, that I don't know.
Yeah. Those details get dialed up later on.
And in this story, it kind of, you know, it also, this story highlights how it's the kind of person least expected by the community did it. So, and that's a feature that winds up getting used in the future too. Well, then once there's a bunch of them, then they've really got to play with it and to keep people guessing, because Doyle's not writing stories to try to get you to guess the end. No. He's thought about that. I remember in that interview he did for The Strand before Silver Blaze came out, and he was like, oh, you know, and I bet you no one will be able to solve this case before the end. So he has it in his mind that is actually people do think about, or, you know, could possibly solve it. And he gives us in several stories, not all of them, but several of them, they are fair play mysteries where you do have all the clues and you just need to put it together.
But he does play with which way he wants to go. Certainly not all of them are fair play.
Yeah. So, so he listens and then he hears the story. Apparently the, Mr. Alec, the young squire, squire to be, or I'll just call him young squire, was smoking a pipe in his dressing gown.
As you do.
Which I like. Yeah. I don't have a dressing gown. You know that? I have a smoking jacket. I think I need a dressing gown to smoke my pipe in sometimes.
So. I'm really surprised that you don't have a dress.
Yeah, you know, my wife got me a really nice smoking jacket, but which I use sometimes, especially in the winter months. But I need a dressing gown. Well, and I have my choice, right, of three colors. I could be blue, purple, or mouse. I could
or mouse.
So we're a checker.
Well, think about it. Put it on your Christmas list. There you go.
Well, Mr. Alk is smoking, and he sees the murder happen. It was two men wrestling outside. One of them was Kerwin, the coachman, and one of them fired a shot and then dropped, and then the other guy ran away.
Mysterious villain runs off into the night.
Yeah, Holmes Wright starts asking questions. He asked the most important question right away. Why was this William? What was this William doing there? And did he say anything? They think that he walked up to check on the house because, you know, they've had that robbery recently. You don't want any balls of twine stolen here. But then Holmes asked the other important question. Did he say anything to his mother before going out?
Right. And this poor woman, old and deaf and described as, the shock has made her half-witted, but I understand she was never very bright.
There you go. Well, and there you go. There you go. The woman becomes half-witted. So,
right. She's half-witted from the shock.
Not you know, grieving because her son was just murdered.
Yeah, no. She's a half-wit now. She only had half to start with, I guess. She's a quarter wit or something. I don't know. This poor thing. But then we get the clue.
A clue, and it's a small piece of paper from a notebook, and Holmes spread it out on his knee, or the inspector did. And this is where in the story we actually get to see it as the characters saw it.
Yeah.
Let me share that here. It is here.
It's really cool how that's presented.
It is. And they show the kind of like here it was cut off here.
Mm-hmm.
So you really get the impression that I'm looking at an actual clue. In the American edition, it's not quite as cool because they take out that torn border. And this is what it looks like in the Harper's text. And actually, you can notice, look at them side by side, that they had to redo it. They had to write it here to make it. So,
because look, the Harper's one has the at closer.
Yeah.
To quarter two. It really shows you the running together.
Yep. Where the quarter runs down here.
And the Greek E's.
And they really got the Greek E well done here.
Yeah.
Here it's here, but not here. And here, well, that's the difference though, right?
Right.
So
that's really cool. Yeah.
They've done a good job of matching it. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, in the printing technology, they couldn't have this just duplicated and sent to them. It was just a lot easier for them, likely, to have it redone on the page here.
That's fun.
And they've also taken out the fact that it's torn. So while you get the impression that this is what they're looking like, this is like a facsimile of the clue.
It's very cool.
That kind of thing is, it's kind of a big deal, I think. It's something the Strand doesn't realize is a big deal. Like later you get lots of, in the 20th century, you get books published that do this kind of thing where they've got all the clues and like some of them come in little pouches and you could take them out and mysteries. This is like the 1930s, I think. There's some like this. In the end, I think that the Strand, and I don't think Doyle realized that the reading public would love to see all the clues and solve the case in that way. You know, like the puzzle aspect, even though in American it's called the Reigate puzzle, I don't think it's developed enough for them to like, you know, really, and it doesn't happen again in, you know, or it happens. We get a couple
sparingly. We get maps sometimes. I think hand drawn. The one with the, was it the stockbroker's clerk, or it's a different case where they're there's a break-in and somebody like redraws the what the setup of the office looks like. But yeah, that sort of immersive experience of reading mysteries.
Because this is very much like, I mean, in this story, this is an immersive, you know, thing in this story that the readers get to see the clue on the page.
In a really interesting, like, second person kind of presentation, as opposed to what the illustrations give you, which is just the sort of outside third person perspective. It is really cool. I like the torn page. It's a nice effect. Really, really immersive.
Now the theories start to come in. The inspector thinks that Kerwin might have been involved. Even though he had a reputation of being honest, he might have been in league with them, and then they had a falling out. But Holmes right away is, this writing is of extraordinary interest. You know, these are much deeper waters than I had thought. And then I love this, the inspector smiled at the effect which his case had upon the famous London specialist.
Cool, we've got a good murder.
Holmes is intrigued.
Love it. Love the description that we get of the change that comes over Holmes in the next paragraph. He starts sort of spinning, right, as the possibility of being an understanding between the burglar. It's interesting, but the writing opens up and he cuts himself off. And we've got this. He sank his head into his hands again and remained for some minutes in the deepest thought. When he raised his face again, I was surprised to see that his cheek was tinged with color and his eyes as bright as before his illness. He sprang to his feet with all his old energy.
He is cured.
So. He's cured. It's the opposite of a rest cure. This is another point in the column for your diagnosis, Ed. That he needs stimulation, not rest.
Yes, you need some rest, Holmes. No, I need another case.
Just needs a nap is what he needs.
I like, too, that he's he compliments the inspector, and he does that more than once, I think, in this story, that, you know, he says... it's ingenious, not entirely impossible supposition. You know, that kind of, you know, that Holmes knows, and he said this in the past, that you need imagination to figure out what these clues are. Imagination, you know, and then you propose a solution and then see if it works, kind of, you know.
It's interesting, right? Because you don't want to theorize without data, but at the same time, you need to have imagination. It's this very delicate balance of how to be a good detective. Imaginative without projecting your theories onto the case.
Well, he's cured now. And now... he leaves to investigate.
The transition we get of him leaving to investigate and being like, I'll be back in half an hour.
Yeah. And he just heads out, starts investigating. Half hour elapsed. The inspector returns alone. He's still walking.
An hour and a half elapses.
Hour and a half.
Back in 30 minutes. He's gone for three times that duration. And then he doesn't even come back.
He's still walking around, and then the inspector's like, I don't think he's gotten over his illness yet. He's behaving so queerly.
I don't think he's okay. Yeah.
Watson says, I have usually found that there was indeed method in his madness. So, which he forgets like, then later. So. Yeah.
He's like, he's just like this. Like, it's fine. He's fine. He's just, he always does this.
Yeah. Watson doesn't doubt that, you know, Sherlock is, you know, he's fine now.
Yeah, this is normal erratic behavior for Holmes, not erratic behavior.
Well, they go and they find Holmes still out in the field, pacing up and down, thinking. Watson,
he's had a charming morning.
Yes, Watson, your country trip has been a distinct success. So, it's very charming investigating a murder.
Yes.
Not the charming time that some of us want from our bachelor week, but Holmes, that's what it is.
Other plans.
They
he rolls with it though. Like, you have to respect, like, this is definitely one of Watson's friends, because like there's a murder next door to him and he's just rolling with it. He's like tagging along on the investigation. He's not freaked out by this. He's like, so what do you think's going on? Cool to watch you work, Mr. Holmes. Like, this is pretty fun. Definitely one of Watson's friends. If somebody was murdered in my hometown, I don't know that I would be like, whoa, that's so interesting. You know, like I might be getting out of town. Take a vacation of my own.
Before we get to, they talk about the clue. Before we get to that, I would like to thank all of you for watching this episode. As a nonprofit organization, the Rosenbach Museum and Library depends on the generosity of friends and supporters like you to keep programs like this free and accessible to hundreds of fellow Sherlockians worldwide, thousands of fellow Sherlockians worldwide. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do so at our website, or by becoming a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, exclusive invitations to member-only events. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. Part of membership is early access to program and course registration. And very soon, there will be some new spring courses and programs that you can register for that we will tell you about as they go up. I think next week, I'll probably make some announcements on this show. And Rosenbach membership makes a great gift. We've had several people watching our shows who have done that, gifted people memberships. I really can't stress how important your support is. So if you haven't made a donation or joined as a member or have the ability to make a further donation, I would invite you to do so and be so grateful. We also have a Facebook group page, Sherlock Mondays, for lots more Sherlockian info, news, links, conversation, and fun. It's always busy on the Facebook group page for Sherlock Mondays. There's an audio podcast version of this show. If you don't, it's the same show, but you don't see me drinking and smoking. But the rest of it goes on just as it does. We just pull the audio off this and make a podcast out of it. So the audio podcast dropped 1 week after the video ones. I know several of you have been asking about Sherlock Mondays merchandise. I'll be making an announcement soon. Just figuring out the details because we had to change the way we get merchandise out to people. And you will have an opportunity to get Sherlock Mondays merchandise before the show ends. So that's about all I can say now. I can say that we have finalized the details for our pay-only Hound of the Baskervilles show. And on the next episode, I will unveil the details and registration will be open for that on the next episode. So that's all I got to say today.
That's exciting.
Yeah, we'll finally make the announcement, you know, on the next episode and people can register for the Hound program, which will be pay only, but it's the same. We're going to do the same show. You're going to be on it and the other co-hosts, and we'll talk about Hound of the Baskervilles in 8 parts. So that'll be fun. Well, back to this story. Holmes and the inspector are now kind of comparing notes, right?
They're discussing, working together, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Nice to see Holmes working a case with somebody.
They're discussing the paper clue, the fragment of paper, he thinks that the inspector thinks it has, you know, the hour of his death written on it, or Holmes does, mm-hmm. Or Watson does. Who does? I think that we are both agreed. This is Holmes. The fragment has the hour of his death on it. It should give us a clue. And Holmes says, it does give a clue. Whoever wrote that note was the man who brought William Kerwin out of his bed at that hour. But where is the rest of the sheet of paper? Mm. And then why was someone so anxious to get possession of it? Because it incriminated him. If we could get the rest of that sheet, we would solve the mystery. And that the suspect, Holmes thinks, probably doesn't realize that a piece was torn off of it. So. Right.
Another example of why there's nothing so important as trifles, right? Here's a dead body sitting in a ditch, but Holmes is really curious about this piece of paper.
Yep.
This fragment of a piece of paper. This literal tiny thing is the crux of the whole mystery. I love this. This was when I was watching, I won't get off topic, but watching Night Country. The new installation of True Detective. Jodie Foster's characters. We're not asking the right questions. Yeah. And that to me is so like Sherlock Holmes.
Very Sherlockian. Yeah.
Gotta ask the right questions. And the question isn't like, who killed William and why? It's where's the rest of the paper? Why did the murderer go so far to try to keep, like, get this paper out of the dead man's hand? Like, what's so important about the paper? So I love that. The idea of asking the right questions is a legacy that we're still seeing in
shows.
In all mysteries.
Yeah.
So they're looking for the paper. They've got to get into the criminal's pocket.
Yeah.
They don't know who the criminal is. So that's tricky.
And Holmes also finds out that it was delivered by the Afternoon Post, but the envelope was destroyed.
Right.
And then Holmes has another compliment for the inspector. You've seen the postman. It's a pleasure to work with you. I don't think he's being, you know, there's times when he's with the police, when he's being so sarcastic towards him.
So condescending.
This isn't one of those. He's like, this is great. You mean not only you have an inspector, but your inspector actually does work to solve a crime? Usually they're just
posting.
Usually they just say like, oh, it's this. And then they don't listen to anything. So,
right.
Yeah. He loves this.
It's great. Do you have any comments about the Queen Anne house? Because I had to look this little reference up.
The Queen Anne house? No, I don't.
Yeah, it bears the date era.
The Maplique on the door. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a note in my Leslie Klinger.
Klinger, of course. Leswood. I'm not surprised.
And it's just. Yeah,
this feels like a Klinger note in the best possible way. Because I read this and was like, what? And went to Wikipedia for this. But I just thought this was such a weird...
That would be 1709. This is less than a year. That would be 1709, the year in which 100,000 British, Austrian, and Dutch soldiers clashed with 90,000 French in the last major battle of the War of Spanish Succession, fought near the village of Maplique, 10 miles south of Mons. The engagement forced the French to retreat, but there were heavy casualties on the Allied side, preventing them from advancing to Paris. It is a fun thing, though, that Doyle puts that reference in there. That, like, of course, you all remember the Battle of Maplique, right? Yes, that's
when it's 1709. He's like, it's an 18th century house. Like, oh, the deed of the Maplique around the lintel of the door. Like, what is that?
I love that. That's somebody who likes military history, and
it's one in there for the boys for boys weekend for military campaigns, for trivia night at the pub. Like, here's Conan Doyle, like, big brain move, working into the future of Sherlockian trivia. Like, he doesn't even know Sherlockians of the future, just like living for these little details. I could see this being in a dastardly Sherlockian quiz, right?
Like, well, I want Sherlock on my trivia team, that's for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. 100%. Unless it's about the solar system. You're screwed. Poison's amazing. Yes, maybe that's what Watson was doing. He was just like screening.
Well, technically it's Watson, right? Because this is
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah. This is Watson.
Yeah, this is Watson. Narration. So it's military history.
He knows that, of course. He's got Colonel, you know, or General Gordon on his wall and
you've got to have the two of them on your trivia team. I mean, it is funny to reframe it that way, right? Like, sitting there evaluating your new roommate to see if he will be good for your trivia team. Doesn't know anything about the solar system. He knows some things about plants, but only if the plants will kill you. He knows a disturbing amount about poison and a lot about, like, geography. No, just dirt. He knows a lot about dirt.
I'm only inviting Sherlock for true crime trivia.
Yeah, that's it. Solar system, you're fired. We pass this little Queen Anne house. They come around to the side of the gate.
And then he goes, he looks at the... this is the scene of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, but as they're there, two men came down the garden path One was elderly with a strong, deep-lined, heavy-eyed face. The other, a dashing young fellow whose bright, smiling expression and showy dress were in strange contrast with the business which had brought us there. Are we supposed to, like, suspect him immediately? Young, flashy, you know.
No idea, because he's like, dashing, right? Like, how can we not trust him? But also...
And then he's mean to Sherlock right off the bat.
Immediately mean.
Yeah. I thought you Londoners were never at fault. You don't seem to be very quick after all. And,
right. Still, you know, at it then.
Yeah. I don't see we have any clue. And then when the inspector starts to mention about the paper.
Yeah. We've only found, and then immediately...
Holmes has his attack. His eyes rolled upwards, his features writhed in agony, and with a suppressed groan, he dropped on his face upon the ground. Holmes has fainted for the first and only time in his life. We'll get to that later, people. Sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
No, you're good. They don't have any context, so they have no idea.
There you go.
What is this, though? Like, it looks like it's going to be a seizure, and then it's not. It's just fainting. Yeah.
And then they carry him into the kitchen, and then he makes a shamefaced apology for his weakness.
For his weakness.
I've been liable to these sudden nervous attacks. Yeah, because he doesn't faint. He does the whole, and, you know, goes down.
Yeah, it's a nervous attack. Yeah. It's not fainting. That's, not...
Banging. We could be banging his head on the wall, like, Father did him in the other story.
Yeah.
My brother's stories tonight either.
This is a good cocktail, isn't it?
Yes, tasty. I like this. I made another while you were talking. You could probably say I turned my audio off for the so I could shake it.
I saw the shaking and didn't hear it.
I had ice, so I made a sound. So
nice. So should we send you home in my trap?
Yeah. So no, I may as well ask you questions.
He's gonna do his Columbo thing. Just one more thing while I'm here.
One more thing. Where was he sitting when he saw the out the window? So he asked
Columbo hates when I don't hang up my dressing gown.
He's asking them questions about what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
Holmes right away is like, well, if the lights were on, why did the burglar try to break in?
He must have been a cool hand.
Yeah, old Cunningham says he must have been a cool hand. It would be a better line from Alec, but the old one says it. And that's awesome too, because that's a taunt.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, or a brag, but in a sense, he must have been a cool hand because it was us.
Yeah, exactly. What a handsome murderer that must have been. He must have been a dashing young fellow and really smart. That is really funny.
He didn't steal anything. And then Holmes is like, oh, we remember this is a peculiar burglar from the strange thing he took from Acton's. What was it? The ball of string, a letter mate, and odds of ends. So he's like,
I don't know what other odds and ends. He knows what other odds.
Yeah.
Ends.
But Holmes is kind of, if he has, he's figured it out already. And now he's like, he's playing with them in a sense. Yeah.
And he's leaning into that, like, oh, I'm not firing on all cylinders kind of thing, which then happens, right? When he like makes a mistake about the time of the crime.
He suggests now you offer a reward, but then he writes the wrong time on it.
Yeah.
And then
Watson gets secondhand embarrassment over the whole thing. Like, I feel for Watson here, right? I was pained at the mistake, for I knew how keenly Holmes would feel any slip of the kind. It was his specialty to be accurate as to fact, but his recent illness had shaken him, and this one little incident was enough to show me that he was still far from being himself. He was obviously embarrassed for an instant while the inspector raised his eyebrows and Alec Cunningham burst into a laugh. Poor Watson. Watson is like,
I don't think the reader thinks. I think Watson falls for it, and I think this is one of those cases, one of those instances where the reader also realizes, like, come on,
he's laying it on thick,
But Watson buys it, And I don't think the reader does.
No.
We also
I also don't think that Watson is trying to trick us here. Like, I really read this the way that's described. Like, I really read this as he's remembering how mortified he was on Holmes's behalf, even though he knows how it all shakes out. And he, like, there are times I feel like where Watson plays up his own, like, fumbly Nigel Bruce-esque bumblingness, right? Like, for our benefit. And you're like, come on, Watson, you would know that. I know that you would know that. This doesn't feel like that. This feels like the way it's described to me, I was just like, oh, this is like the same reason I can't watch the American Office. Like, this secondhand embarrassment is just, it's too much and I can't take it. And I feel like this is Watson remembering his own reaction to the situation.
And it shows how close they are and the friendship that they have. That, you know, that's another example of these, you know, these are two men that feel a great deal for each other.
That's very sweet.
We also get a reminder here, too, about the when Holmes asks him to do the to send the reward, said the JP, the Justice of the Peace. He's called Justice of the Peace earlier, too, when you first hear about him. And the irony that the Justice of the Peace, the person who is in charge of meeting out justice in this area, mm-hmm. is one of the criminals in this case.
Can't trust anybody.
Well, the squire laughs, and but Holmes gets his father to write the words,
mm-hmm.
order 212. Now he has his handwriting sample. Holmes put the slip of paper carefully away in his pocketbook. He's got the evidence. Well, he's got what he needs to then clarify further. He wants to get the actual, you know, sheet.
He'll bring the case. He knows at this point, you're right, how it shakes out, but he's gathering evidence so that he can prove it.
Yeah. And he's trying to, you know, now he's asking questions. He's trying to get them off, you know, off of his suspecting them that he knows anything, that, oh, I just had some more questions.
Checking to see if the lock has been forced.
Watson says, I could tell from his expression that he was on a hot scent. And yet I could at least imagine in what direction. Says we're leading it more and more. We're getting it. We're getting the Watson, like, I have no idea what's going on. I shouldn't say more and more. It's always been there. But I think the effect you have in reading the stories is over time, it starts to have an effect on you. And it does lead you to start to think that Watson isn't that smart. But I think it's only because it's a repetition of the same thing happening that he doesn't understand something and will say, I don't understand something.
Right.
Which is actually the way to get smart, is to admit that you don't know what it is and then you get it explained to you. But
Watson's a great student.
There's also that hot scent, and that I think it's still, this is still a new thing for that, using that hunting metaphor for criminal investigation. The scent to solve a mystery or a puzzle had already been used for, you know, over 100 years now. You can find examples of it, but now it's in particular to the detective. And it's not the first time in Sherlock Holmes stories. It's happened before where, you know, Holmes is hot on the scent like a bloodhound, mm-hmm. you know, that hunting, but it's hunting in a city, or, you know, to solve a crime. Here it's in the countryside as well, but it's particularly tied to a detective solving a crime, which is often how you see it, hear it. You know, I think you hear that on the scent more with crime solving than anything else now.
Yeah, and we see in the Holmes stories the move from the literal being on the scent in The Sign of the Four, where they take Toby out to literally trace the scent. And then we get the metaphor of Holmes as the bloodhound on the scent of the crime.
I do a quick search and see what other stories it's in. But I mean, the right scent, this is Toby in the beginning here.
Toby,
but then, good boy. Yeah. But then, no, it's right away with other cases right off the bat. It winds up being used frequently by Doyle. It's something that he probably has a hand in popularizing to use for criminal investigation. I say probable because I haven't done the full investigation.
I don't know, but it does sound probable. And I would love to hear from our listeners if they've done research in that direction.
The son makes fun of him about that.
Because he sucks.
Yeah. You must try around and get on a fresh scent, I fancy, with his malicious smile. Well,
love Holmes walking around taking key note of the architecture of the house.
Yeah.
Just making everybody think he's a weirdo, just leaning into the weirdness.
And then he gets the man into the chamber. He holds back. And as they go into one room, and then read that as we passed it. Go ahead.
What? as we passed it, Holmes, to my...
I'm sorry, wait, we skipped. We threw the set near the foot of the bed. There you go.
Oh, yeah. Hey, God. Near the foot of the bed. Near the foot of the bed.
It's one sentence before, that's all.
Oh, yeah. Near the foot of the bed stood a dish of oranges and a carafe of water. The inspiration for this drink. As we passed it, Holmes, to my unutterable astonishment, leaned over in front of me and deliberately knocked the whole thing over. The glass smashed into 1,000 pieces and the fruit rolled about into every corner of the room. "You've done it now, Watson," he said coolly. "A pretty mess you've made of the carpet."
That's funny. So, and it just, you know, and it looks funny too. Like they're walking around and all of a sudden Holmes is like, push the table over. "You've done it now, Watson."
Orange is rolling across the room. Like the illustration's pretty good in The Strand. Do you have that handy? I have my like reader's copy, but I mean, I'm just like straight up pushing the thing over. Like Watson's nowhere near it.
There he is. Watson looking like, "My God, what are you doing? What ineffable twaddle is this?
What the deuce?"
I love, and it is. The orange is all over the floor here.
This must have been so much fun for Padgett to do. Yeah. It's like, I get to draw oranges rolling all over
the
place.
And Holmes has got this like little mischievous look going on here on his face. Look at him.
Yeah, because I mean, if people are being rude to you, why not just like break their shit? Yeah.
I'm just going to knock your stuff over here.
I have nervous fit. Sorry, I broke your Waterford vase. Like,
no. Well, but there,
I'm not there, well.
There is a method to his madness. He does it to create a diversion. And then
Watson picks up the fruit. Everybody's like confused. Everybody blames Watson. I love that. He's like, "Understanding for some reason that my companion desired me to take the blame upon myself, the others did the same." Like everybody else is like, "Yeah, Watson."
But then Cunningham's realized he's gone. They run into the other room.
They think he's off his head.
And then we hear a sudden scream of "Help! Help! Murder!" With a thrill, I recognize the voice as that of my friend. I rushed madly from the room onto the landing. I love Watson heroic here, right?
Oh, God.
Bryce, which had sunk down into a hoarse, inarticulate shouting, came from the room which we had first visited. I dashed in and on into the dressing room beyond. The two Cunninghams were bending over the prostrate figure of Sherlock Holmes, the younger clutching his throat with both hands, while the elder seemed to be twisting one of his wrists. In an instant, the three of us had torn them away from him, and Holmes staggered to his feet, very pale and evidently greatly exhausted. "Arrest these men, Inspector!" "On what charge?" "That of murdering their coachman, William Kerwin!"
Dun, dun, dun! Amazing.
The picture's good, too.
Yeah, this is a good one, too. Padgett must have had a great time at this.
There they are. I mean, choking him out here and trying to get the paper. They are
twisting the violinist's
serious
wrist
about this. So, but the whole, you know, arrest them, what charge for murder of William, like it's become a cliche.
It's
not quite a cliche yet. It's just
drama.
Something you encounter on stage, of course, especially, and you encounter it in these kind of stories. But, you know, it is, you know, you can't get away with that kind of scene now without it seeming silly.
Right. Although you sort of accept it from Holmes because you know that he's got a flair for the dramatic.
It is. And part of it is that, you know, dramatic flair that he wants to create this scene of, you know, where this can all occur. And he does. And he has. He's the inspector's like, what? No, you don't mean that. And he's like, look at their faces. They're completely guilty.
I love that too. Like, you can imagine them like pan over and the two of them are just like so guilty.
And then the son, of course, you know, he had dropped all that jaunty, dashing style, which had characterized uh-huh. him, and the ferocity of a dangerous wild beast gleamed in his dark eyes and distorted his handsome features. And then he starts to pull out a gun. And,
yeah.
You know, would you drop it? He stuck out.
I love out that. Just,
yeah. So
it is interesting that the handsome man, the mask, of his handsome face gives way, right? Yeah. He becomes distorted. He becomes ugly, as we see that he is, in fact, ugly on the inside. We're still leaning a little bit into that Victorian physiognomy.
And Holmes and Doyle lets the inspector knock the gun out of his hand and kind of, you know, do that. That it's not something that Holmes does, and it's not something that Watson comes in and does.
No.
He gives it to the inspector. This inspector is good. He's like, he's not even, you know, Cunningham doesn't get to drop on him. So That's what Holmes did in the Red-Headed League. He's the one that knocks the gun out of the hand of John Clay, you know.
Because everybody bitched about having to do their late night camp out. So he was like, fine. Oh, it's late. Oh, it's dark. I'm missing work for the, you know, like.
I'm missing my I'm missing my weekly card game.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
I'm just whist for this. Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, this is a great inspector. It's a shame we don't see more.
Well, wait, do we even get his name?
I don't know that we do. He's the local inspector.
He's just the inspector. I don't think we even get his name in this story.
Which is a shame. Oh, Inspector Forrester.
Oh, it is. We do. Inspector Forrester. Thank you. Yeah.
Good. Good. I'm glad. That would make me really sad if we didn't.
We get a name, but we don't know anything about at the end of the very end of the story. Weird. But the he has the dramatic accusation. They're guilty. He's found the message in the dressing gown that's what Holmes thought happened. He just put it in his dressing gown, didn't realize that there was a piece torn from it. And then Holmes goes off with the inspector to ask some more questions because, you know, he loves having all the details. He can't stand not to have any little details cut out of this.
Where was the rope?
Yeah.
Did you bring your own rope?
So.
What happened to the twine? Yeah.
So, why did you take the, why'd you choose?
You can see this being a.
But he comes back as good as his word to explain the case to the colonel's smoking room. And with him, he brings Mr. Acton, who is robbed first, and it was his case against the Cunninghams that they knew about as well. And he's going to tell them what happened. And he also says, I'm afraid, my dear Colonel, that you must regret that the hour that you took in such a stormy petrel as I am. What a great expression, huh? The stormy petrel. Which is a bird, everyone, the petrel is, when you see the petrel, you know a storm is coming. It's a harbinger of a coming storm or danger, so for sailors. So,
what a little emo kid he is. I love that for him.
What's that?
I said, what a little emo kid he is. He just like I'm a harbinger of doom. You know? Like, I bet you regret it. This is why Watson and I are buds. Like, I think this is great. Like, this is, I consider it my greatest privilege to have been permitted to study your methods of working. I confess they quite surpassed my expectations, and I am utterly unable to account for your result. I have not yet seen the vestige of a clue.
Yes. And, you know, Holmes is, you know, he's sorry that I'm going to disillusionize you, because it's always been my habit to hide none of my methods, either from my friend Watson or from anyone who might take an intelligent interest in them. Of course, they're always revealed by the end.
Yeah.
But now he's been so shaken up that I think that I shall help myself to a dash of your brandy. The brandy cure! I love the brandy cure in these stories. So,
always.
There you go.
The only real doctoring we get
needs a bandage. That's all we needed. I needed, you know, to recoup. I just needed a murder to solve and a brandy.
It's amazing. A couple people to make an attempt on my life.
Oh.
Precious gauze to ruin. Carafe, rather. I love this. I trust that you had no more of those nervous attacks. And you, we'll get to that. We'll come to that in time. And then he lays
first,
out.
First, let me give you a lecture on the art of detection. And which he, you know, which he starts to give here, you know, recognize which facts are important.
Yeah.
Scrap a paper, you know, because of course, if Alex Cunningham's account were true, then the paper wouldn't have been torn because you know, they were wrestling for the gun and he wouldn't have taken the time to tear the paper out of his hand. Holmes goes through the clues that have led him to realize what was going on here.
Yeah, he does actually walk you through, right? He tells you, like, you have to be able to recognize which facts are important and which are incidental and which are vital. You have to have no prejudices. You have to follow docilely wherever the facts lead you.
Because the inspector did. The inspector had a prejudice in that he just didn't think that the county magnates, the justice of peace, would have been involved. So that prevented him from, you know, looking at it with fresh eyes and realizing it that no, this could be a solution to the case.
Right.
Could lead to a solution. And then we get to the examination of the paper clue once again. Mm. And the handwriting and all of these things. I mean, just I'll briefly just read this one. When I draw your attention to the strong T's of at and two, and ask you to compare them with the weak ones of quarter and 12, you will instantly recognize the fact. All of these, you know, handwriting things at several months before Doyle had written this story, or actually shortly before he had written the story, I'm sorry, he had been corresponding with Alexander Cargill. Now, Cargill was a writer, he had some medical training, and he had sent, I think he even knew Bell. I think he knew Dr. Bell. He had sent Doyle an article that he had written for the Edinburgh Medical Journal, which was also edited by Dr. Joseph Bell. Maybe that's how he knows Bell. The man, of course, who Doyle modeled Holmes' deductive abilities on. This is the kind of stuff that Bell used to do with his patients.
Mm-hmm.
Cargill's article was called Health in Handwriting, in which he posited that handwriting could reveal the mental and physical strength of the writer, even age, and sometimes even tell you if the person had mental health problems. In the Baker Street Dozen, which is a collection of the 12 stories that Doyle picked as his favorite stories, as the stories he thought was best. But each of these stories also has an essay in it. There's a Reigate Squires, because Doyle picked this story as one of the 12 best stories that he wrote. And Richard Lancelin Green, a great Sherlockian from the past, has a quote from the letter Doyle wrote back to Cargill after reading this Health and Handwriting. He says, after reading your excellent articles, I am almost afraid to write to you for fear you should discover imbecility in the dots of my eyes or incipient brain softening in my capitals. You have given me quite new ideas, and I thank you for them and can recognize their truth since they tally with every man's experience, though I never saw them condensed and formulated before. I would like now to give Holmes a torn slip of a document and see how far he could reconstruct both it and the writers of it. I think, thanks to you, I could make it effective.
Cool. And I didn't know that. That's so cool.
And Holmes and Doyle got some, he got the hair being cut off and saved from Copper Beaches from his mother. He got this little clue idea from, you know, someone who's been reading his stories and sent them in and used them.
Great.
So I love that. And then also in this story, he goes on about it. We get 560 words here of handwriting analysis in this book. That's that I, you know, I read the beginning of it, and then it goes for 560 words about the handwriting in the story.
Sherlock Holmes, amateur graphologist.
Poe would have loved this. Poe would have been so in love with this thing. I mentioned how Musgrave Ritual was, you know, partly inspired by Poe's The Gold Bug on this episode. Poe also had a series in his life that he wrote for Graham's Magazine and I think others called Autography, in which he took autographs of usually famous people, and then he would delineate their kind of psychological character and show how this, you know, person, you could read this in their signature.
It's so interesting because graphology like got super popular, like I feel like around the same time that like astrology was having a resurgence fad, and a lot of it's been debunked in terms of like, can you tell things about people's personalities based on like the way they draw their letters. Although if you see Conan Doyle's, any of the facsimiles, I mean, his handwriting is so neat. It's ridiculous. But at the same time, like the theory about being able to tell about somebody's physical health based on their handwriting, I think there probably still is, some truth to that. In my discipline, there is, a very famous scribe, I want to say from like Northumbria, medieval scribe, and we only know him as the Tremulous Hand of Worcester. and there have been all kinds of articles. Yeah, there have been all kinds of articles about like what kind, like, is this a palsy? Is this like a, you know, was he drunk? Was he not? Like, what was this a degenerative condition? And it's amazing, but it's, there's some of this that.
One thing you can do, which Holmes is onto, and is that you can identify people, that your handwriting is extraordinarily distinctive. And if you get enough samples of it, you can really identify someone by their handwriting, that it becomes the kind of, you know, it's kind of fingerprint-like in a sense. And Holmes, though, even with 560 words of this story, he leaves out 23 other deductions, of course, that, you know. Yeah. And Holmes would have been happier if Watson had written the story. I'm sure, like, if later he commented, I'd be like, you know, why didn't you include the 23 other deductions in the end of your story? But that's...
Watson's like, you want to burn our house down.
Where's the monograph? We need the monograph on that. That's not one of his monographs that we know of. So...
It's true.
But there must have been. All right. That's it with the handwriting. And then it is, he tells about the wound. He examines the wound on Kerwin. There was no powder blackening on the clothes. This is a very, you know.
Early ballistics.
Yeah. A criminal, you know, forensics going on here that, oh, there's no powder blackening, so it couldn't have been shot there. And then obviously because of the ditch, there was no boot marks around it. And, you know, they would have left some. And so he knows, right, like, Cunningham just lied. None of what Cunningham said happened. So now, knowing with the lawsuit between Acton and the Cunninghams, this is where Acton breaks in and he talks about, you know, well, if they had gotten, you know, a single paper about this, my case would have fallen apart.
Crazy.
And this is where Holmes confirms. He says they tried to divert suspicion by making it appear to be an ordinary burglary, to which end they carried off whatever they could lay their hands on. All this, this is all, that is all clear enough. But there was much that was still obscure. And then now he has to find, he knows that Alec took the paper out of the dead man's hand, but he has to find out where it is. And this led
reasons him. It's got to be in the dressing gown.
Yeah.
Probably well, still
where,
there.
Yeah. And this is where he explains why he fainted.
The inspector was about to say, well, the only clue we have is the piece of paper, and so he had to like dramatically throw himself into a fit, and the colonel being like, do you mean to say all our sympathy was wasted on you, like
and Watson says, then what?
Yeah, speaking professionally, it was admirably done, cried I, looking in amazement at this man who was forever confounding me with some new phase of his astuteness. Just the glowing admiration. Yes.
Holmes so, responds, it is an art which is often useful. So, you know.
So lovable. I love him so much. Great
actor. He's a great actor. And, you know. And he
fooled the doctor into thinking it was in keeping with the with his previous symptoms. Although I do love he explains it, and Watson's just like, "Oh, what an ass I've been."
Yeah. Then it's again. I could see another their closeness here, right? I could see that you were commiserating with me over my weakness. He's laughing as he says it, but you know, but sorry to cause you the sympathetic pain, which I know that you felt. So now he tells them this is why he knocked the table over so we could get to the paper, but that's easy enough for us to figure out as well. But he says his son, Cunningham, afterwards, as to the motive of the crime, was tractable enough, but his son was a perfect demon, ready to blow out his own or anybody else's brains if he had got to his revolver. This is later, the home saying about their interview. But old Cunningham has made a clean breast of everything. That Williams had secretly followed him, the Cunninghams, and saw that they had broken into Atkins. So then it was a blackmail thing. That's
I mean, good for William that he was going to use this for his own.
He was going to blackmail his masters. Yeah. So the squire. And now's where we get the other letter. And in the Strand, then they put the two clues together and we get the clue formed now. And let me share the image of this. And I'm going to share it along with the image from Harper's. Because again, Harper's has to redraw it. So it's so the handwriting's slightly different that you can see.
Oh, yeah.
But Harper's also doesn't add the rest of it. And I think because they haven't already done this division here and shown it as an actual torn piece of paper, so which is a, you know, I think doesn't work as well. It'd be nicer to see the whole thing together, that you just get to see this part of it now. And is and then we get the whole message. If you will only come round at 11:45 to the east gate, you will learn what will very much surprise you and maybe be of the greatest service to you. And also to Annie Morrison, but say nothing to anyone upon the matter. I'm Annie Morrison!
Like, you never get to know about Annie Morrison.
There's another thing about this case here that Holmes, for all of his giving us, finding out every tiny detail by the end, we don't, he just says, of course, we do not know what the relations may have been between Alec Cunningham, William Kerwin, and Annie Morrison. What?
That's I really need to know.
What is that loose end? That's surprising for a story like this. That's surprising for a Sherlock Holmes story. It's surprising for Doyle to have a loose end. Now, of course, Holmes thinks that, you know, it's over. We caught the bad guys. So it's over and done with. And he never wants to have other people suffer, in a sense. So that makes sense in a way. Like, what if we find out that, you know, she could be hurt by this? So he's kind of, but or maybe he just knows that the inspector knows who she is.
Or he assumes it's like some sort of like romantic entanglement drama that like really is not really not interesting to him.
I think she's gone off to meet Rachel Howes at the end of Musgrave Ritual. Rachel,
God, I hope so.
There's a place where they're, you know, where they're together.
I got a lot to talk about.
Annie Morrison.
It's wild. It's so wild. Yeah, just introduce a whole new like surname. Like, there's nothing to attach her to anybody else.
And part of it, too, I think is nice for the reader, too. Like, there's some other, there's some more here for us to contemplate, for us to, you know, think about. But it's only for us, because Holmes is, you know, that's it.
He's I feel like Doyle's, like, writing and, like, he's like, oh, and then he, like, reaches his word count. And he's like, you know what? I don't care. Done. Fine. Whatever. Amy Morrison, but I don't give a shit. I've reached my word count. I'm done. I'm good.
Well, he does, Holmes does take the time, Natalie. Let me talk more about handwriting. Cases of Hereditary, shown in the P's and the tail end of the G's. Like, I can't give this, I can't stop talking about this.
Won't shut up about the handwriting. Watson's like, but what about Annie Morrison? Probably. And just, Holmes is not
Annie Morrison? Look at the initial, look at the tails of the G's.
Can you imagine them just like in the carriage ride, like back to the train station, and Holmes is just going on and on and on about the handwriting? They're on the train back to London.
Absence of the I dots and the old man's writing, Watson, don't you see?
Watson just sitting there on the train, like, I'm so glad you're feeling better, but I really wish you would shut up.
Well, we get a great final line here. Read the final line.
Watson, I think our quiet rest in the country has been a distinct success, and I shall certainly return much invigorated to Baker Street tomorrow.
And then if this was a 70s TV show, you would finish that line, and you and I would go, like, Watson and Holmes would go like, and it would be a freeze frame of us laughing, riding back to Baker Street.
So, Perfect.
This is absolutely a TV episode from 70s, 80s crime TV. So
yeah. It's like a Murder, She Wrote meets Matlock, meets Columbo, meets insert your favorite buddy cop show here.
It really works. The more I think about it, the more I like that he doesn't give us Annie Morrison at the end to give us to think about, to imagine something going on here. And also that the more I think about it, the more I think that that's what Holmes does. Yes, he likes to tie things up, but he doesn't necessarily like people punished if they don't have to be punished.
Yeah.
And clearly Annie Morrison didn't murder Kerwin, so, you know. There you go.
No sense in dragging her and her name into this or through the papers.
Well, Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 23, right? Of Sherlock Mondays. Mary, thank you for coming back for this one. You'll return in April for...
Yes, I'll return for the return.
Episode 29, The Empty House, right? Because we're 30 episodes and you're the next. Yeah, and you'll be in the penultimate. So,
penultimate episode.
Our next show, episode 24, Anastasia Klimchinskaya will return for another look at the lasting impact of the British Empire. Complete with the story of an adventure in India by the Crooked Man. So I love these stories that, you know, where things that have happened over in one of the colonies, Australia, India, one of these places, comes back to have some really criminal effect on what's going on here.
I did an academic paper on this, the contaminating colonies, how, you know, you can come back home, but you're going to bring India with you. And there's a real threat that you could set that loose.
Yeah. Well, that'll be the Crooked Men, but we also get with Crooked Man, but we also get Teddy.
Teddy! And the hot Teddy, which I had a lot of fun with. I was like, what am I going to do for a cocktail that's not going to give something away with the plot? And then I was like, oh, I have something for this.
There you go. Well, thank you also to our chat, Mrs. Hudson, Brianna, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosaback through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also to care for our collections. You could also become a member of the Rosaback. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. You can find out more at our website, rosenback.org. Again, let me remind you to subscribe to our channel, to like these videos. If you're listening to the podcast, please leave us a review. Thank you, Mary. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ed.
Everyone, I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenback Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Thanks. Good night.
The Rosenback Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays. Sponsored by Lisa Washington. Hosted by Edward G. Pettit. Music by Pleated Gazelle.